Terry, my name is Nancy Morris, and I'm an alcoholic. I wish there was a porta potty up here. I don't know how I could go any more than I've already gone. I'm having a great time. I'm being well taken care of. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me here today. I got a message a few weeks ago that somebody would meet me at the airport. And, you know, that was it. And my husband gave me this message. I said, well, do they know what I look like? And he said, no, they didn't ask. They just said somebody would be there. So I got off the plane, and there was Jean with a sign that had my name on it. So that was really simple. You guys are really organized, because I spoke somewhere not too long ago, and I was told the same thing. Somebody will be there to meet you. And I didn't see anybody with any sign with my name on it, so I hung out. And as it came to pass, there were these two people there with signs, and they had their own names on them. But I didn't know what their names were. But Jean's taking very good care of me, and I really appreciate that. And I'm enjoying myself so far. I don't know if this means that I'm getting better or I should keep coming back, but I understood everything that Jim said yesterday. So here I am up here. I was in my room before, you know, on my knees on the potty. And I thought, you know, I don't have a talk and I don't know anything. So I'm screwed, basically. I used to know something, you know, when, for a while here I thought I knew something, but, you know, it seems the longer I'm sober, the less I know. It's just the strangest thing. And it's so simple, as, you know, as Peggy talked this morning at the meeting. This is so simple. You know, I go to meetings. I go to the same meetings every week. I don't think about it. I just go. I work with others. My phone number's listed. I read the big book. And, you know, and I stay sober. And I turn this over. Whenever I talk, I turn this over to God. Because I don't really know what to say, and I don't want to plan it. And, you know, I've come to believe in God's will for me. This has been a process that's happened to me over the years. I used to think that God's will was like a maze, you know, and I had to follow these certain paths. And when I got to the inside of the maze, you know, then I would get my money, property, and prestige. And I've come to realize God's will is, you know, whatever is happening at that moment. And my rewards, I get my rewards every day. It was like what Sherry was reading in Working with Others. And the feelings that I get in working with other people and watching them change and grow and in turn work with others. Those are the rewards that I get every single day, because there isn't anything that I've ever experienced that's made me feel as good as I feel when I'm working with another person. So this program is fantastic. I feel very fortunate to be here. I'm going to tell my story. I come from an alcoholic family. I have five brothers, a mother, and a father, and a sister. My five brothers are all sober today. This took like a period of 11 years. I was the first one in my family to join Alcoholics Anonymous. We all drank when we were growing up, but, you know, we didn't know anything about alcoholism. We just drank. My father had a built-in beer keg in this extra refrigerator that we had. And I used to save up empty jars during the week, and when he would put the keg in on the weekend, I would fill my jars up with beer and put them in my closet, because everybody in my family drank so much. We were such pigs, you know. And so when I would hear that the keg was emptied, you know, it made that noise, I would just go in my room and drink my beer. And so, you know, I was the first one to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober for about 3 years before my first brother came in. And as I said, it took 11 years for the fifth one to finally quit drinking. My father died of alcoholism when I was about 6 months sober. My sister is not an alcoholic, and I wish she was, because she's very unhappy. And she goes to therapy, and she, you know, is searching for to be happy and comfortable and peaceful. One time I told her that. I said, I have the solution to your life. I know how you can be happy. Go out and drink, take drugs, whatever. Go to jail, get in trouble, and come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and your life will be okay. I think that my mother went to one Al-Anon meeting in her whole life, and I think she found out there that they work on themselves and not on us, and she's never been back. You know, it's so funny, this disease, because my father used to drink quite a bit, and she would complain about that all the time, and then my father died. And the first person that my mother started seeing after my father died was a man that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. She did not meet him in AA, but he was one of the worst slippers I'd ever met. He was always getting hit by cars and burning down his trailer and calling people in the middle of the night to help him. My mother meets this man somewhere. I think he was riding his bicycle down the street and he fell over in front of her car, and she screeched to a halt and said, "That's my kind of man." And she dated that man for about 5 years, and then he finally got sober and stayed sober, so she couldn't be with him anymore. She's married today to a man who doesn't work, and so she's, you know, still happy. But that's the way it is, you know. So, I grew up in this family. We always drank. I never really thought about it. You know, one time I went to the cupboard to sneak some vodka when I was a young teenager, and I got it, but it was already pure water. Somebody had gotten there. So you had to get up pretty early in the morning, you know. But I went to Catholic school. You know, we were a good Catholic family. And I went to Catholic school for 10 years. And the reason that I had to stop going to Catholic school was because they didn't make maternity uniforms in those days. And, you know, it's kind of a meaningful situation to me. I was 15 years old when I got pregnant. I didn't have a boyfriend. I'd never been on a date in my life. And it was kind of like the Immaculate Conception. I tried to tell them that, but they didn't buy it, you know. But, you know, what was behind all that was that all my life I've been a people pleaser. Now, everything that I know now, I didn't know when I got here. I didn't know anything when I got here. Then, after I was here for a little while, I knew a lot. Now I don't know anything again. But I didn't know anything when I got here, absolutely nothing. I didn't know words like people-pleasing and doormat and fears and insecurities. I never talked like that in my whole life. But I was a people-pleaser, and throughout my whole life, I had to do whatever anybody asked me to do or dared me to do. You know, I could never say no to people, so I used to hang out at this stable that was across the street from my house, and there was a guy that lived up in this stable. He lived in a little room, a little shack, and he was a lot older than I was, and he was really a bum. But this man dared me to sneak out of my house in the middle of the night and come up there and meet him. And I had to do it because he dared me to, and if I told him no, I couldn't do it, he wouldn't like me. You know, that's how I had to live before I got here, and for a while after I got here, too. So consequently, I, you know, climbed out my window in the middle of the night, went up there and met this man and got pregnant the first time I had sex in my life. That convinced me of that God, you know, up in heaven watching every move I made. But in those days, you know, it wasn't as accepted as it is today, and my family sent me away to live with another family, all the while pretending that I was visiting relatives back east, because this was a real disgrace to my family. So I was 15 years old, and I felt like I was about 8 years old, and I had to go live with these people and clean their house and take care of their kids. So I did that, and I was afraid all the time. And I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning on the day that I was going to have this baby. I woke up with labor pains. And I sat on the side of the bed, you know, and I thought, well, I guess I should go wake these people up and tell them that I'm ready. And then I would think, you know, what if I don't have the baby right away? They'll probably be mad at me for waking them up so early. And so I just sat there because I always felt like I was bothering people, too, and that nobody really cared and, you know, wanted to have anything to do with me. And so I just sat there rocking back and forth by myself and thinking it would just be easier to have the baby than to go bother them, you know. So that's what I did, and you know, it all worked out okay. I had that child, and I gave it up for adoption. And you know, the really neat thing that through all that, you know, as years passed by, you know, and I was ready to have children, I found out I couldn't. And I have 3 sons who are all adopted, and you know, because of this program and the attitudes that we're able to have here, I think that's the greatest gift. You know, I think God gave me this wonderful gift that I was able to have a child and then adopt, you know, and so I got to see this thing from all sides, and I think that's really pretty neat. So basically I drank through my teenage years and, you know, never really gave it much thought because everybody I knew was drinking like I was drinking. And I got married the first time because a man asked me to marry him. It's basically, you know, as simple as it was. And he's a nice man, he's still a nice man, he's also sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I couldn't say no to him, you know, and I was just taught that I would grow up, get married, and have children, so that's what I did. So my drinking was progressing all the while, and I didn't really pay that much attention to it. Before I got married to this man, I was working in a dental office for a number of years, and I've always preferred alcohol. But when I was working in that office, you know, I couldn't really drink because my main job was standing over people with that vacuum and sucking the water out of their mouth, you know, and I had to be pretty close to them. So I hid my drinking. I thought, you know, I didn't want anyone to smell my breath. So in that office, we had a lot of pills, you know, for nervous patients. So I was a nervous dental assistant, so I took pills all day long, and I just took them because they were there. I took them because I didn't want anyone to smell alcohol on my breath. When I was working in that office, you know, another thing, you know, I don't like to hear the word no. I don't like to be rejected, and I have a hard time saying the word no. I thought I deserved a raise when I was working there because being a good alcoholic and so insecure, I would go into work about an hour early every day, and I wouldn't take a lunch hour. I would shampoo the carpets on the weekends, stay 2 hours late, you know. And I thought I deserved more money for that, but I couldn't ask my boss because he might say no. But I was the bookkeeper also, so I just gave myself, you know, I just took it. The way, you know, what I learned when I got here, what I was doing was called embezzling, but I didn't know that at the time. It seemed perfectly okay to me. But I, you know, I used to work in that office, and I felt just like I was so self-obsessed all my life. Still have a little bit of it. I just thought that everybody that came in there was looking at me and thinking how dumb I was, and I was a dental assistant, and what a dumb job, and isn't she fat and ugly and everything else, you know, and maybe they even got on the phone with each other afterwards and talked about me. And I used to just really have a hard time, you know, if a patient was coming in and I knew they had, like, money, or the women were dressed nice, or, you know, it just made me feel more worthless. And I remember one time this man was coming in, and I knew he had money, and he was nice looking and all that, and I just felt just like, oh, I just can't do this. And I thought, what can I possibly say to him? I want him to think I am somebody, and I'm smart, and I know something. And so I went through all these things, and I really don't know much about anything. So I thought, well, he has a daughter who used to come in here, so maybe I can ask him how his daughter is, and then that'll start a conversation. But then I would think, well, maybe his daughter died since the last time, and so that wouldn't be, so, you know, I would just bring these people in. But So I worked in that office, and then I got married, you know, for the first time. And this is when my drinking, you know, really became very noticeable to me because, you know, over the course of years, I ended up with 3 children, you know, and a husband. And my boys were small when I got sober. I have twins who were 3 years old when I came here and another son who was 1 year old. And so basically I got stuck in the house. And so I had to do my drinking by myself. And, you know, I tried to start out slow and drink only after 12 o'clock because I thought, well, you know, the men that are businessmen go out to lunch and they drink. And I'm a housewife, so my lunch hour is 12 o'clock so I can drink. So I would do that for a while. I tried drinking just beer for a while. I would drink a couple 6-packs of beer. After a while, it didn't do that much for me, except I had to go to the bathroom a lot. I was quite heavy, and that didn't do much for me. So then I would drink whatever we had in the house. I used to get into our liquor supply when I had to, and I didn't have a car all the time that I could go replenish it. So I would fill the bottles with water. And one time we had unexpected company come over to our house one night, and the first thing we did was give our friends a drink. And so my husband made these people water and tonic that night. And I think it's funny now, but at the time, you know, I was sitting there ready to die because I thought that I was going to be discovered. And I always thought I was going to get caught. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or alcoholism as a disease. There wasn't that much said about it. And I thought that I was a bad person and that I was the only woman especially doing what I was doing. I couldn't take care of my kids. I tried to let them go out and play, but one of them would get on his big wheel and go 3 miles from the house, and I couldn't find him. And I was drinking then. I drank earlier. I would drink at 11 o'clock because I would say that I got up early that day. My lunch hour was a little earlier that day, so I could drink at 11 o'clock. And, you know, it's so funny that I did do this every day. I fooled myself, and I would come up with very valid reasons every day why I could drink. And it just got to be earlier and earlier. And I used to try to socialize with the neighbors a little bit. And but I was drinking, and I smelled of alcohol, and so I didn't want to do that. I used to go into their houses sometimes when they weren't home and go into their medicine cabinets. I lived at the end of a cul-de-sac, so I would climb over the back fence sometimes and go into people's houses and take pills out of their medicine cabinets and liquor and money. And I was in my house supposed to be, you know, a wife and a mother, and I really felt bad about the things that I was doing. I used to peek out my drapes an awful lot, watching these women and making fun of them, because I felt like a little girl in this house. I had no idea what I was doing there. I was the wife and the mother, and you sure could have fooled me. I used to peek out my drapes at these women, and I would make fun of them to myself because they were wearing dresses and they were wearing makeup, and I would think, why do they dress like that? They're just home cleaning up their houses and things. What's the big deal? Because I didn't know how to wear jewelry and makeup, and I didn't feel like little girls dressed like that, and that's, I just felt like a child. One of my neighbors was very nosy, and I didn't like that, and she would be outside, you know, in the street talking to the other neighbors, and I would go to my telephone, and I could see the street from where I was, and I would dial her phone number. And she was really top-heavy. And she used to hear her phone, and then she would just plop across the street and run up to her door as fast as she could to answer the phone. And as soon as she would get to her front door, I would hang up. And she would go for this like 3 times. I would do it. Now, you know, this is not really very exciting to me as far as drinking goes, you know, but this is what I was doing in my house during the daytime to amuse myself. I couldn't go out. I couldn't socialize anymore. I was very bored in my house by myself. Well, one other thing I used to do is I used to rearrange the furniture quite a bit because I was so bored. And we have 3 levels to our house. So I would be very creative and I would make like the living room the bedroom one day. The other thing that I did was dye my hair. Like every other day I would just put something on my hair and make it a different color. So by the time I got here it was many different colors and it was sort of crackly and falling out and it was... But, you know, I don't really think very many exciting things happened during this time as far as, you know, getting in trouble because of this disease. I used to get sick. I was hospitalized once with pancreatitis, you know. But it was like I would not talk about my drinking. My husband knew what I was doing. He was marking the bottles. I knew he was marking the bottles. But I would make 100 marks on the label so he could never figure out which his mark was. And he could just never quite catch me at it. And so I'm acting like this, and I'm drinking like this, and I'm really thinking that my life is pretty much hopeless. I really did feel bad. I mean, I started to feel worse and worse every day. One day I just really would feel sorry for myself, and one day I just couldn't deal with the kids any longer, and I put a lock on the outside of their bedroom door, and I put them inside there, and I went in my backyard. We had a mountain at the end of our backyard, and I just took my bottle of wine up on top of the mountain and just sat there and drank and cried and felt sorry for myself and thought the world is passing me by and nobody understands me and I don't know what to do. And I went back inside and opened the bedroom door, and being little boys, they'd climbed over everything, and the big dresser had fallen on top of one of them and cut his head open, and there was blood everywhere. And another time, I just left him in the backyard and didn't pay any attention to them, and one of them drank charcoal lighter, which is not that great. And, you know, they survived. I recently was out in California visiting one of my neighbors, and you know, she told me that she knew everything that was going on, and she used to keep an eye on my kids for me. And I didn't know that at the time. I thought I was fooling everybody, but you know, I just was feeling worse and worse and worse. I felt like a very bad mother. I felt sorry for my children. I felt sorry for my husband. You know, every day, based on the age of the twins, who were 3 when I came here, you know, every day during that period of time, I tried to figure out a way that I could drink, a reason. I came up with a reason every day. And as I remember it, I used to get up in the morning and I would say, please God, I don't want to drink today. And then I would come up with a good reason that I could have a drink. And I would say to myself, okay, I'm just going to go have one drink. And I said that every day for so many days in a row. I'm just going to go have one drink. And then I would have another one, then I would have another one, then I would have another one. And I drank all day long. And I didn't know how to stop. I tried not drinking sometimes and I couldn't do it. So that's how it was. And the day that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we had company over and I was making Bloody Marys. And I never left the punch bowl and I drank from the time they got there in the morning until they left. And when the last man left, I walked out the door of my house and I got in his car with him. And he drove me to somebody else's house and we drank for a couple hours and my husband didn't know where I went. And I called him up and I asked him to come pick me up. And it was really the first time that he really let me have it about my drinking. He had been completely aware of it for quite some time. He was very worried about the family and what was happening when he wasn't there. And he really let me have it. And, you know, I didn't think that I couldn't not drink. I had to drink. So my solution when he confronted me, my solution was that I would leave them because I had to drink. So I picked up the telephone and I called up this old boyfriend of mine. It's like the old boyfriend, the one that you have really good memories of, and it might 10 years might have passed or 15, you know, but you feel you can just call up and go, hi, it's me. Because you think about him all the time. But I called up this guy, and I asked him to come pick me up. I didn't have a car, and I thought that he could come over and pick me up and drive me to the next town and leave me there enough. I just wanted to live there by myself. And that's what I thought I was going to do. So I was on the telephone with him, and my husband walked into the room, and he said to me, "I don't care where you go, but you can't run away from this." So maybe it must have been my time to come here, because I hung up. When he said that to me, I felt like somebody kicked me in the stomach right at that moment. And I kind of pictured myself living in this other town by myself, but hating myself. I would be there. I knew I hated myself. I had a hard time looking in the mirror. If I had to go somewhere with my husband, I had a very hard time looking at my face in the mirror. And so I knew that I would be there. And I hung up the phone, and I called my husband's brother, who was a Catholic priest, and he lived in Pennsylvania. And I thought that being a priest, he could pray for me. And the only thing that I had ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous up to that time was there was a little article in our newspaper in the classified section that said, if you're a woman alcoholic and you have a drinking problem, call this number. You know, I would go get my newspaper every day during the last year or so, and I would open up the paper and see if that little ad was still there, but I could never call the number. I never had the courage to do that. So I really basically knew nothing. I thought this priest could pray for me and that might help. So I got him on the telephone, and it took me about 10 minutes to get it out of my mouth that I had a drinking problem. And, you know, I thought that I was going to be locked up in the basement of the mental hospital for the rest of my life, and when anybody found out what I was doing. That man told me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He had been to see what it was like so he could tell other people. And he told me to go to a meeting. So this was on a Sunday, and I was used to mostly just wearing cut-off Levi's and white T-shirts at this time, and I was very heavy, and I was comfortable just dressing like that. And so my husband said he was going to take me to a meeting, and he tried to find out where one was, and I went upstairs to get dressed, and I picked the nicest thing out of my closet. It was an orange polyester pantsuit, and my hair was a very bright orange, and it and green and yellow and everything else. But I thought that I looked pretty nice, and I had been drinking all day. And I believe, you know, as we say, I don't think alcohol was working that well for me, because I was pretty aware of what was going on. And my husband put me in the car, and we set off to go to this AA meeting. And by the time we finally found the meeting, it was about 20 minutes after 9, and the meeting ended at 9:30. So we went in. There were about 30 people sitting in this room. There was a middle aisle, and there were chairs set up, and there was a man up at the podium talking, and we went in and sat down, and I had absolutely no idea what was going on. And the minute the meeting was over, the minute they closed the meeting, all 30 of those people came to me and gathered around me, and I saw a cup of coffee and literature and phone numbers and a piece of cake, and it was just a sea of faces moving around me, and I started throwing up on the floor. You know, I always say, like, most meetings they say, newcomers, will you raise your hands? You know, I threw up. And I felt very embarrassed, and I ran outside the door, and there was a parking lot, and all 30 of those people came outside to the parking lot. And they were kind of like standing around me holding hands. They were so happy. I always think it was like ring around the newcomer, you know. And I found out later, you know, it was kind of a small area, and I found out later they had not had a newcomer there in quite a long time. They all wanted to get in on this thing. So there we're out there in the parking lot, and I'm continuing to throw up, and they're continuing to laugh and be happy. And I remember this one man looked up at the sky, and he said, "We alcoholics are such lucky people. We're chosen by God." I didn't feel like that right then, exactly. I pretty much thought my life was over. And that was in January of 71. My sobriety is May 23rd, 1971. you know, I loved what I heard right away. I mean, that night I went home. Some ladies wanted me to stay there, and they told my husband they would talk to me and then bring me home, and I wouldn't do it. They scared me. I was holding onto his leg like I was a 2-year-old, you know. I said, no, I'm not going to stay here with these women. And so he took me home, and the next day I was just sitting on my couch kind of staring at the wall, and these ladies came to my door. And there were two women who were in their 50s. They were at the meeting that night, and they brought another lady with them who was in her 30s. And I found out later she was in between slips, but I was 26 years old, and they thought that they would kind of scare me away because of the age difference. So they captured this woman on a good day, and they brought her. And basically, they sat in my living room that day, and they told me their stories. It was the first time in my life I had ever had anybody talk to me like that. It was absolutely amazing to me what these women were telling me. They were telling me all my secrets. They were telling me everything that I was ashamed that I'd ever done. It was the most wonderful experience. And I felt instant relief. I really felt some hope that I would not drink. They left after a while, and they came back and got me and took me to a meeting that night. And I remember at that meeting, now we're on Monday night meeting, and in the beginning of the meeting, then they did ask for newcomers to raise their hands. And I remember putting my hand up and putting my face down and looking to the ground because I felt so ashamed of what I was. And it was so hard for me to believe that everybody in that meeting was an alcoholic. I just couldn't comprehend this thing. So that started me on meetings. There's like a 4.5-month gap between, you know. I stayed sober for 4.5 months, and I loved it. But I'll tell you what, I did not get a sponsor. I desperately wanted to have a sponsor. I probably had 25 phone numbers that women gave me. I would sit at my telephone the next day, and I would really want to call this woman up. And I would sit there and look at her name, and I would look at her phone number. And then I would think, okay, I'm going to call her up, and then she'll say, who is this? And then I'll have to say, this is Nancy, and she'll say, well, I don't know you. And I'll say, I'm fat, ugly, and orange. And, you know, I didn't think very much of myself, and if I had to describe myself, it would all be negative things. And then I thought, once this lady realized who I was inside, she would go, oh, no, it's her. I didn't really want her to call me. And that's not true. I hope there are newcomers in here today because we love newcomers. We really do. And, you know, but I couldn't make that phone call. And because I thought I'd be bothering these people again. And if it wasn't for newcomers, I probably wouldn't be standing up here today. I just love working with other people. That's what, as Jim was saying yesterday, and working with the men that he sponsored, that's how I learn everything. Not with the men he sponsored, but with the women I... the women I sponsor. But, So during that 4.5 months, I went to meetings. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I'm sober and I'm going to the meetings. I'm not talking to people about anything else. And I think I had doormats stamped on my forehead. And one thing that happened was this lady asked me if I'd watch her daughter one night. And I said, sure. And she brought her daughter over and she came back 3 days later to pick her up. Now, to her face, I said, oh, that's fine, no problem, don't worry about it. You know, you could leave her here till she's 18 years old if you want to, it's okay, you know, I don't mind. And, you know, that's how I was all my life, and when I was a teenager, I used to walk down the street with a can opener in my hand, and I would scratch the paint off of cars as I walked by, because I was getting back at all of you people for the things that you made me do all the time that I didn't want to do. And, you know, and that's I was just this doormat people pleaser, and so that bothered me that this happened, and I had things come up that I needed to talk to somebody about, but I didn't talk to anybody about them. And one night, you know, I was getting ready to go to my meeting. My husband was late coming home with the car, and I didn't think that he should treat an alcoholic like that. I thought he should be on time so I could get to my meeting because I might get drunk, you know. And I happened to have this wine in my refrigerator. I used to cook with wine. And I would have about a quart when I needed like a teaspoonful of wine. And I don't cook with wine anymore. I don't have any alcohol in my house at all. You know, I have like some days of sobriety built up, but I'm still an alcoholic. And, you know, I might start thinking too much one night and I might go drink it. I don't have any alcohol in my house. But I had it then and he was late and I didn't think that was fair and all these things had built up and I wasn't talking to anybody. So I went in and, oh, about 3 days before that I was at my mother's house and the pressure had started to build and my mother had tranquilizers so I helped myself to some of them, telling myself that that was okay, that this was Alcoholics Anonymous, those were pills, this is alcohol, I could take these pills, that's fine, knowing that wasn't right. But 3 days later then when I wanted to drink, I said, well, I took those pills anyway, so I might as well drink. So I went in and drank this cooking wine, and my husband came home, and I told him what I did, and he said, go to the meeting, and I said, okay, and I got in the car, and I went to the 7-Eleven, and I bought a half gallon of Spinata wine. And, you know, it was a real funny thing. When I came in, like 4 months prior to that, 4.5 months, I thought that I was a bad person, and I had done things that I was ashamed of, and they were bad, Then I heard your stories for 4.5 months, and you had worse stories than I did. Now I felt like nothing again because I don't even have a good story. So I'm going to drink this wine, and I hope I get arrested tonight because that would be really cool, and then I can come back and tell everybody I went to jail. That would be great. But I got this wine, and I drove around and drank this wine, and I sat outside the AA meeting watching all those jerks inside that meeting, and I'm drinking it. And then I drove on the freeway, and I finished the bottle, and I threw it out the window of the car, and it crashed on the road, and I just kept driving. Nobody saw me. Nobody cared. And I went home, and I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was face down one more time in my own vomit and stuck to a blue shag carpeting in my den. And my husband, I pried my face up off the carpeting, and he was sitting there on the couch, and he, you know, he had been to a few Al-Anon meetings, and so he wasn't, like, about to do too much for me at that point. He just left me there. I went back to a meeting that night. I'm very fortunate that that's the way it was, because this is a very serious disease that we have. I have had friends that I have seen over the years get drunk. When it seems like they're being active and involved, everything seems like it's okay, and they may have 5 years, they may have 11 years. I've seen people drink, and it happens a lot. We're very lucky. I am, anyway. But I went back to a meeting that night, and I didn't quite have that spark of hope that I had 4.5 months prior to that, because I thought when I came in here, I'll never drink again, and then I did drink. And so I didn't quite have that hope, but I have been sober since that time. I met some people out where I live who were members of the Pacific Group in California, and they just started taking me over there right away, and I'm so grateful for that, because I was younger and I needed this action and involvement and all the activity that went on there also. So I lived about 45 miles away from the meetings I went to, but I went every night to my meetings. And actually, you know, it wasn't like a huge sacrifice. I got to get away from the kids and all that stuff, but I did it. And whatever the motives are, we do it. I started going to those meetings, and the journey began, and it's still going on. I learn new things every day. A woman came up to me shortly after I got to this new group, and she said, I would like to be your interim sponsor. And I was so grateful to that woman for doing that, because I still had a hard time walking up to somebody and asking them to be my sponsor. And she was my sponsor for the first year of my sobriety. She died of cancer a few years ago, and she died sober, because those are the kind of actions that she took. I did my fourth and my fifth step with that woman, and that was probably one of the hardest things that I ever had to do, was to write the fourth step and then to do the fifth step. I used to sit in the meetings and look at the steps on the wall, and I would get to four, and I would think, I can't ever do that. And there are certain things I can't ever tell. And, you know, it seems to me that just about everything that was a secret to me, I heard from podiums and I heard at my woman's meeting. So, but I was still afraid to do it. It was me. I had to be vulnerable, and I didn't really want to do it. I finally got it written, and the day came for me to do my fifth step, and I called my sponsor, and I said, I'm resigning from Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do this. And I really meant it. I did not want to do it. And I called another lady finally, because I just stayed home and cried for 3 hours because I wanted to be sober and I wanted to be in AA, but I didn't want to do that. And we talked a little while, and I finally called my sponsor back, and I went and did my fifth step with her that night. And, you know, looking back on that, I feel like the door opened a little bit to the freedom that I've come to know in AA, and the freedom from my fears, or at least knowing how to deal with these things and the insecurities and the feelings of self-worth and no confidence and things like that. And that opened the door a little bit for me that night. I felt more a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did something I really didn't want to do. I took that step. And also, you know, I was married when I came in, and I had these three boys. And about 2 weeks after I was sober, I wanted to get a divorce, and I wanted to go to college and take about 100 credits all at once. Catch up for lost time. And my sponsor at that time told me not to do any of that. She told me to go to AA meetings every single night and to make Alcoholics Anonymous first in my life. And I did that. And you know, one thing, I did that. I did what my sponsor told me to do, but I also did things behind her back. And since one of them just popped into my mind, I'll tell you. I don't really want to, but I will, because it's there. But, you know, also about like 3 weeks after I got sober, I was in a meeting, and I saw this guy across the room, and I thought he was like really nice looking and all this stuff. And so he used to talk to me all the time. And, you know, I call him a professional newcomer snatcher. That guy, he knew what to say to me, you know. He knew how I felt inside, and so he used to talk to me all the time. And so then, you know, he dared me to meet him after a meeting, and so I had to do it. You know, you don't get well when you just walk in the door here. And I would meet this guy after meetings. And, you know, I had my husband and my three kids at home, and I felt pretty guilty about what I was doing, and I wasn't telling my sponsor, certainly, because she'd probably tell me not to do it. And I wasn't really telling anybody, because I knew it wasn't right. And but I continued to do it anyway. And it got to the point where I thought I was going to get drunk. I felt really bad about this. And I stood outside of a coffee shop one night where I knew the people in my group went after meetings. I was at the meeting, but I didn't go to coffee, and I stood out there, and I told myself I would just talk to the first person who walked out the door, because if I didn't, I was going to get drunk. And I talked to this man, and he told me to call my sponsor the next day. And I said, she'll hate me. And he said, you call her, and you promise me you'll do that. And I called her up, and I went over to her house, and her sponsor was there, and the three of us sat and talked about this thing. And that was a great moment, because these women shared things with me. You know, I always thought I was the only one doing these kind of things. I always thought I was the only one feeling the way that I felt. And that's the great thing about our program. You know, we're not different, and we're very much the same. And, you know, so these women helped me to stop doing that. And my sponsor told me, you know, not to leave my husband, and that I had to stay in that marriage and be the best wife and mother that I could. And when the time came, you know, I would probably know it. So I did try to do that, and I didn't see this guy. And and I went to my meetings, and I tried to be a good wife and mother. And at 3 years of sobriety, you know, I ended that marriage. And you know, that was a really growing period of time for me, because I was now out on my own, and it seemed like for the first time in my life. And my friends rallied around me so much, it's unbelievable. And people went with me to help me find an apartment. I didn't know how to do that, and I did not want to admit that I didn't know how to do these things. I always thought that I was capable and independent, and I could do anything. But the thing is, you know, when I was younger, or even not when I was younger, I used to, like, like hit people and get mad at them, and I thought that was being that made me tough, you know. And I was so scared when I went out on my own and I had to become self-supporting and I had to get a job and I had to get an apartment and I had to take care of these kids and go to meetings. And they went with me on job interviews. They sat in the car while I went inside. I used to when I would fill out an application, you could not even read it. My hand shook so bad. It was just so scary to me to be doing all this, but these people helped me to do it, and I got a job as a dental assistant, and I got an apartment, and I took care of my kids, and I did that for about the next 6 years, and we were very poor sometimes, you know, but, you know, the people in my group were great, because one time I went home, and I found this note on my door, and they were increasing my rent by quite a bit, and I couldn't even afford it as it was. And I called this woman up, and she just said, "Oh, you know, knock it off. You're not going to go without a roof over your head." And, you know, it was like no big deal. And, you know, I believe that God, you know, is helping me to learn what I need to learn along the way. And it was necessary for me to live that way for the 6 years that I did, taking care of these kids and just really struggling to get by. And, you know, I had to get to the point where I liked it and I accepted it. And I remember one day I was standing in my kitchen and I had this incredible feeling, and I thought, if this is the way it stays for the rest of my life, it's okay. And that was incredible, because, you know, I'm always thinking ahead and I've got to get this money together and do this and go to school. And I thought, it's okay, just like it is. I had always been taught by my sponsors during this time to work with others. The first time my sponsor kind of ordered me to do that, and I had another woman the second year, and I told her, "I can't go talk to that woman over there because she's really pretty and she has on nice clothes and they're expensive and she won't want to talk to me." And my sponsor just went behind me and shoved me across the room and stood there and watched me, you know. And I've always been taught to work with other people, and I've learned so much through that. You know, that girl wasn't thinking that about me. I sponsor women now, and, you know, I just learn everything through them, because I sponsored this one woman, and she's attractive, and one day she called me, and she said, "You know that girl at the meeting?" And she told me her name. She said, "I try to go say hi to her all the time, and she just ignores me." The next day, I just started sponsoring the other girl, the pretty one, and she was pretty also, and she came to my house, and she said, "You know, I walk around the meeting, and I put my hand out and try to be friendly with women, but nobody wants to talk to me." You know, and it's like, I learned through these women, you know, that my thinking is not always valid. It's not usually valid, you know. And I think working with other people has probably been the most valuable tool that I've given in this program. And I've gotten the greatest rewards from that, as we were talking about in the beginning. I had the opportunity in my sobriety to sponsor two nuns. Now, that was great, because you know, like, so I thought, well, I can get back at them now. You know, I got my ruler out. Like, 7 meetings a week, sister. But I sponsored these nuns, and they both did their 5th steps with me, but one of them I remember in particular, because this woman had an awful lot to share, and she was in her 40s. And she did her 5th step with me, and she was able to talk about things that she had never talked to anybody in her entire life about. And we both sat there and cried, and I'll never forget that, ever. That was incredible. She's sober. She's doing great. She sponsors people. Another lady that's in my life who has she's about 14 years sober, you know, I got a call one night. I was on my way out the door. I was kind of running late to my meeting, and I got a call from central office, and they asked me to call this woman, and I called the number, and I said, "My name's Nancy. I'm going to an AA meeting. If you want to go, fine. If you don't, fine." And that was kind of in a bad mood that night. And she said she'd go with me, and I drove over and picked her up. She was living in this apartment, and the no lights were on, and this woman's face was purple, and she was shaking, and she didn't look like a human being. And I took her to the meeting, and I went around asking people, what am I going to do with this woman? She might die before I get her home. And, you know, she sat there, and the next day I went over to her house to visit her. I took one of my sons with me. He was young, very young, and when we left, he goes, God, Mom, that woman is so sick, you know. And but I went and visited her, and I would bring her to my house, and the next week I took her back to the same meeting I had first taken her to, and we drove up, and she said, why are we going to this hospital? And I said, this is where the meeting is. And she had no recollection at all of the week before. And she's sober today, and I watch her pass on the sobriety through women she sponsors. And it's just incredible. The kids, you know, my kids, one time I stopped after work at one of their Little League baseball games, and I was selling photocopy machines by this time, and I sat in the stands, and one of my sons looks up, and he yells, and there's lots of people there, and he goes, hi, Mom, how was your day today? I said, fine, John. And he said, did you sell any machines today? And I said, no. And we're yelling this back and forth. And he said, well, how was your attitude? Good? And one time in my sobriety, when I got into one of my obsessions, you know, over the only man that I, you know, I can't live without this man, I'll die without him, and I can't even remember half their names anymore, but I was into one of those, and I had let it get a hold of me, and it became a very bad obsession, and I was sober a while, and I was making myself available to this man for the 1 hour a week, you know, that he would visit me, and so I had to cut down on my meetings a little bit, and sit by my telephone, and so I was in my bedroom, you know, rocking back and forth. I had really gotten quite nuts with this thing, and one of my sons came to the door, and I mean, I was like to the point where I was passing money under the door for them to go buy food. And my son came in, and he took me by the hand, and he took me out of the room, and he said, the longer you stay in here and think about this thing, the worse it's going to be. And he's like 8 years old. So they've been great. So, you know, it was a good time during those 6 years. I had to become a responsible person and learn how to take care of myself and my family. And I got married again when I was about 9 years sober, I guess. And I still wasn't very well because this man's very nice, but I didn't want to marry him, but he had bought a ring. So I felt kind of bad about that. And so we had 3 years of marriage. And he's sober, I'm sober, we're all fine. The boys lived with us most of the time, and then my second husband and I were fighting quite a bit, and a lot of screaming and yelling and carrying on. And my kid's dad, he used to call up, and he was sober in AA. He had remarried. He married an ex-nun. After me, he had to marry an ex-nun. But he used to call me up. He was a very good father to the boys, and he used to call me from time to time and say, you know, we would love to have the boys live with us if you would ever like them to do that. And I used to say thank you, and I'd hang up, and I would think, I could never do that. I'm a mother. And I used to even kind of criticize other women who let their kids go live with someone else. I thought, that's not right. And the boys were like my image, you know, Nancy and her boys. And I used to just think, no way I could ever do that. So this marriage continued to get worse and worse, and the boys were living there. And one day, you know, I was getting pretty much in the habit of getting on my knees every morning and asking God, you know, to take over. And so during this time one day, I heard this message, you know, and it said the boys should go live with their dad, and it was like, where did that come from? I don't think I could do that. And then I said to myself, I can't do that. I love these boys. And then I heard, well, if you love them so much, why don't you do what's best for them? And their dad was really a good dad, and he had a good job, and he had a big house, and he has a very nice wife. And so I went down and talked to my sponsor. By this time, Clancy was my sponsor. I went down and talked to him, and he said, I think that's a good idea. You call them up and tell them what you're thinking, let them discuss it, and then you go talk to them. So I did that. And, you know, I got down on my knees one day, and I asked God to give me the strength and the courage to do this in the right way and not do it and then look for sympathy from people and to talk about it and say I didn't want to do this and how terrible it was. And I asked God to give me the strength and the courage to get through this in a dignified way, and that's exactly what happened. And I knew in my heart it was best for everybody, and it was just fine. And we've all maintained a great relationship through this. We all spend holidays together, and they include me. Well, I go out to California quite a lot. I stay at their house, my ex-husband and his wife, like right on the end of their bed, you know. And now I have my own room. So we all get along great. And one of my boys has gotten in trouble. And he had come back to live with me when he was like 18 years old. I went and got him one day because they had to ask him to leave. They had certain rules, and he couldn't follow these rules. And they had to ask him to leave, and they didn't want to do that, but they had to. And he was out for 6 months living in just in a really bad situation. And every day I would get on my knees, and I knew I couldn't do anything about it, and I asked God for the strength to deal with the situation and please take care of Chris. And I would go on about my business and not think about it anymore. And then again, after about 6 months, one day I heard, you know, go get Chris, he's ready. And I went and found him, and I said, come home with me. So he lived with me for a while, and my new husband, I have a new one, he's sticking so far, it's pretty good. During that time, you know, I came home one night, and there was a message from my son who told me he was in jail. And that hurt a lot because, you know, I thought I had really done a good job and that would never happen. And that really hurt me quite a bit, but I asked for the strength to deal with the situation. I had to take him to court, and I had to hear him be sentenced, and I had to just, you know, let him go. And, you know, it's really funny because he got in trouble another time, and I, being a good mother, you know, took care of the whole thing. And this time he had to go to jail. And I said, okay, God, help me to deal with this. And my answer was, you know, this is necessary for him. You took care of it before. He didn't learn anything. This is necessary. And so, you know, we survive these things, and we share these things with other people. And I stayed with that husband a little while longer, number two, you know, and one day I sort of cracked up, and I had 12 years of sobriety, and I sponsored a lot of women in my group in California, and I just couldn't deal with this situation, and I basically got a plane ticket and got on an airplane. I packed up 3 suitcases, and I went to Hawaii because one of my brothers was living there and I had a place to stay, and it was a very small town in Hawaii. And I didn't tell anybody I was going. I wrote notes to all the girls I sponsored, and I wrote notes to my sponsor, and I said, I'm leaving forever. I'm never coming back. And I really meant it. I really hurt. And I went to Hawaii, but I'll tell you, the first thing I did was I got off the airplane and I went to AA meetings there. There were about 15 people in the group, and I became a part of that group. And I stayed sober, and I stayed there for 7 months. And of course, my husband divorced me while I was gone because he didn't like me being gone that long. And so I went back, and you know, I started hanging out in my meetings again, and I'm 12 years sober, and I'm thinking, this is not right. I don't have an apartment. I don't have a car. I don't have any money. I don't have any children. I don't have a husband. This sucks. And I'm 12 years sober, and this is not right. And I would sit in my meetings, and I would look at all the people that I got sober with, and I would see how they had grown and, you know, gotten houses and businesses and whatever, and I just thought I was really screwing up. And I felt, you know, bad and kind of depressed, but I went to my meetings. I was trained to go to these meetings, and I thought that I had done enough over the years, and I'd helped people, and now somebody should help me. People were helping me, believe me. I I was living on people's couches. You know, I was staying with women in the group who some of them I barely knew, and they'd say, I'd love to have you come stay with me. And I met a lot of people who are good friends in my life today because of that situation. But I felt very bad about it, and you know, I would talk to people and try to find the answer, and the answer was that I had to continue to do the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what. I have to do the same thing day in and day out. I don't build up insurance or anything, and so I started doing that, and you know, I started feeling better, and I wasn't looking to get married again, but I was like hanging outside the men's restroom at the meeting, so you're bound to find somebody, and so I'm married to Ed today, and we just celebrated 6 years of marriage, and he's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this relationship, this marriage is unlike anything I could have ever imagined. There's complete trust, there's respect, you know, we have a very comfortable life together, and we're both very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful for that. I feel good almost all the time, and you know what, when I feel bad, I don't even have time to notice it anymore because I'm so busy all the time, and that's great. You know, as I said before, there's the basics, and I do the basics, and I don't even think about it. So, you know, that night that my husband was driving me to that meeting, and I was at my very first meeting, and I knew my five brothers were all bad drunks, and my father, and I was sitting in the car, and I was thinking, why me? This is not fair. And, you know, today, I say the same thing, but I say, why me? I am so lucky to be here. Thank you very much.